has dwindled to a trickle of 2 prayers per year. The choristers alone go from strength to strength, and their music is indeed magical. Even I feel a twinge of guilt as a member of that fellowship for a trust betrayed. In the understanding of his own time, Wickham was doing the equivalent of a rich man today, making a large down payment to a cryogenics company which guarantees to freeze your body and keep it insulated from earthquake, civil disorder, nuclear war, and other hazards until some future time when medical science has learned how to unfreeze it and cure whatever disease it was dying of. Are we later fellows of New College reneging on a contract with our founder? If so, we are in good company. Hundreds of medieval benefactors died trusting that their heirs, well paid to do so, would pray for them in purgatory. I can't help wondering what proportion of Europe's medieval treasures of art and architecture started out as down payments on eternity, in trusts now betrayed.
But what is really fascinating about the doctrine of purgatory is the evidence that theologians have advanced for it. Evidence so spectacularly weak that it renders even more comical the airy confidence with which it is asserted. The entry on purgatory in the Catholic Encyclopedia has a section called Proofs. The essential evidence for the existence of purgatory is this. If the dead simply went to heaven or hell on the basis of their sins while on earth, there would be no point in praying for them.
For why pray for the dead if there be no belief in the power of prayer to afford solace to those who are as yet excluded from the sight of God?
And we do pray for the dead, don't we? Therefore, purgatory must exist, otherwise our prayers would be pointless. QED. This seriously is an example of what passes for reasoning in the theological mind. That remarkable non sequitur is mirrored, on a larger scale, in another common deployment of the argument from Consolation. There must be a God, the argument goes, because if there were not, life would be empty, pointless, futile, a desert of meaningless and insignificance. How can it be necessary to point out that the logic falls at the first fence? Maybe life is empty. Maybe our prayers for the dead really are pointless. To presume the opposite is to presume the truth of the very conclusion we seek to prove. The alleged syllogism is transparently circular. Life without your wife may very well be intolerable, barren and empty, but this unfortunately doesn't stop her being dead. There is something infantile in the presumption that somebody else, parents in the case of children, God in the case of adults, has a responsibility to give your life meaning and point. It is all of a piece with the infantilism of those who, the moment they twist their ankle, look around for someone to sue. Somebody else must be responsible for my well-being, and somebody else must be to blame if I am hurt. Is it a similar infantilism that really lies behind the need for a God? Are we back to Binker again? The truly adult view, by contrast, is that our life is as meaningful, as full, and as wonderful as we choose to make it. And we can make it very wonderful indeed. If science gives consolation of a non-material kind, it merges into the final topic, inspiration.
Inspiration. This is a matter of taste or private judgment, which has the slightly unfortunate effect that the method of argument I must employ is rhetoric rather than logic. I've done it before, and so have many others, including, to name only recent examples, Carl Sagan in Pale Blue Dot, E.O. Wilson in Biophilia, Michael Shermer in The Soul of Science, and Paul Kurtz in Affirmations. In Unweaving the Rainbow, I tried to convey how lucky we are to be alive, given that the vast majority of people who could potentially be thrown up by the combinatorial lottery of DNA will in fact never be born. For those of us lucky enough to be here, I pictured the relative brevity of life by imagining a laser-thin spotlight creeping along a gigantic ruler of time. Everything before or after the spotlight is shrouded in the darkness of the dead past or the darkness of the unknown future. We are staggeringly lucky to find ourselves in the spotlight. However brief our time in the sun, if we waste a second of it or complain that it is dull or barren or, like a child, boring, couldn't this be seen as a callous insult to those unborn trillions who will never even be offered life in the first place. As many atheists have said better than me, the knowledge that we have only one life should make it all the more precious.